Last night at the Kansas City Public Library, there was a packed house. But it wasn't because of the free burrito coupons Chipotle was dealing out, or because of the presence of a celebrity author, but because of a conversation about the urban farm movement with ethnobiologist Edwin Marty. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's program, Edwin Marty will join us to share practical advice for budding urban farmers, such as composting and keeping livestock in the city, and decontaminating toxic soil, and even changing zoning laws where urban farming is concerned. We'll also hear about some of the more interesting examples of urban farm programs and progress that he's discovered across the nation. That's ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. City, everything is a matter of perception. For instance, green leaves breaking through the pavement show at once the power of nature's dominion over humankind's notion of progress and development. To others, it could be a sign of blight, a need to patch infrastructure. But to our guest today, that green breakthrough through the concrete is a symbol of hope and a harbinger for fundamental changes that urban farming could bring to our society this century. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is Edwin Marty, one of the authors of Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. He's an ethnobiologist as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about your book, Breaking Through the Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. Why did you decide to do it?
Well, what I'd seen farming for 10, 15 years in the inner cities of places all over the country was that there was no introductory book to show the general public what was happening around the country, and that what I saw was this incredible grassroots movement bubbling up in every corner of every city around the country. And yet, as I traveled around and as I worked in Birmingham, people just said, you know, what are you talking about? What is this? They just didn't understand it at so many different levels, the very basic idea of urban farming. I mean, for me, it seemed so obvious, but yet there was this general misunderstanding. So I decided that the best thing I could do and the funnest thing I could do would be to drive around the country and document these great projects that I'd heard about and put it together in a book and send it out to the world.
And you pose that question in your book, what is urban farming? What is an urban farm? And suggest that it's not a static definition. Tell us here, what is an urban farm?
Right. Well, it's a complicated question. So one of the intentions of the book was to interview all the different urban farm practitioners that we met around the country and kind of get a sense from their perspective, what is urban farming? So we got 15, 20 different answers, about as different from one to the other as you could possibly get. Catherine Kelly from Cultivate Kansas City, I think, had one of the best answers, which is if you're farming and you look up and you see buildings, you're urban farming. Pretty straightforward. But again, that's sort of more of a description, not so much a definition. So what I came up with was this idea that you are intentionally producing food or some kind of plant products within a city limit and then either giving those away or selling them. And that important part of intentionally producing products is really the defining characteristic.
So intent and proximity are two of the determinants.
Exactly.
In the definition of urban farming. So when the garden center at Home Depot is growing vegetables, that's not urban farming.
Right. And I think it's very important, that intentionality. Like, they are producing a product, or they're actually just passing a product through for sale. A more advanced thought that I've had since writing the book is really looking at the intention of where the product will end up. And so looking at food production and other plant-producing farms inside a city limit that are supporting the city itself. So the products are not being distributed outside of the city. And so not only is it geographically focused, there's an intentional focus to having those products stay within a community.
You suggest in the title of the book and throughout the book as well, thematically, that we're going through an urban farm revival, the key word on revival. What's a revival about it? What's happened to our food system in the last century?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things we touch on is this idea of urban farming is a really, really old idea. I mean, it's one of the oldest occupations for humans on Earth, producing food in proximity to a city. Before the advent of trains, before the advent of refrigeration, the vast majority of fruit and vegetable operations had to be urban farms, because, you know, moving food on a, you know, horse-drawn carriage was a pretty laborious activity. You had to be within, say, 25, 50 miles of any farm. So really up until 1850, 1860, every single city was surrounded by a ring of farms. That all changed radically over the last 100 years. We've seen a complete exodus of urban farming. So really going from 150 years ago, 100% of farms that were producing, you know, food quality products were urban. Now, you know, 0.001% of them are. So that idea, you know, it is a revival. It's a return to an original idea that cities are dependent on food production for their very existence, and the proximity of the farm is going to dictate the size of a city.
And if the current trend holds, this urban farm revival that you've documented and that you've observed in your 12-city tour and in your book, if it holds, what does food look like in another 100 years?
All right, that's a great question. My dream, you know, the vision that I have comes from Cuba, comes from Havana, where 80% of all the fruits and vegetables that are consumed in Havana are produced in Havana. So you have every square inch of every single vacant piece of property, every single rooftop, every single planter has some kind of food product coming in it. So we're inundated and we're surrounded by food. We think about it every day. We talk about it every day. It's just ingrained into the fabric of our existence. And I mean, currently, nothing could be further from the average American's existence. Food is something that you think about maybe for 10 minutes at a time, three times a day. It comes and goes, and that's it.
And it's usually the consumption of it.
Exactly.
Not the necessarily production. The origin or production of it.
Yep.
You traveled around to several urban farms around the country, 12 cities in all. What did you learn was the common thread with these urban farms?
I mean, it was really the interesting part is almost that there was no central common theme, except that there are so many people excited about this idea. I mean, the farms that we saw in New Orleans, Vietnamese immigrants growing on the riverbanks of the Mississippi to, you know, quarter-acre rooftop farms in Brooklyn, New York. I mean, nothing could be more different. And yet the passion of the people doing it is the common theme, that there are just so many people, every walk of life, every demographic, every economic strata, every racial profile, everybody in these cities is just so excited about producing food and having that sense of connection back to their food. I mean, that was really the common element, was passion. People so excited.
I guess to literally drive the point home, you traveled around in what you called a Frybrid veggie grease powered short bus. Tell us about that experience.
Right. So
give us some veggie tales.
Right. So this school bus was named Lewis Lewis. It was named after the original farm manager from the farm I started in Birmingham, Jones Valley Urban Farm. Lewis Lewis was a Vietnam vet, self-proclaimed ridden hard, put away wet individual. Tough life, but he was a survivor and just an amazing guy. So he ended up actually passing away while working at Jones Valley through a tragic aortic aneurysm. But we felt like naming this school bus after him would be an incredible tribute. So we bought this bus and retrofitted it to be a little bit more appropriate for our needs, hooked up some communication systems to it, and started out. So the idea is that we were going to be able to obviously travel cheap by getting free used cooking oil from places all around the country. And there's pretty good ways to find that product. So started out in Seattle, drove down to California, up to Denver, Kansas City, down to New Orleans, up to New York City, over to Detroit, really making the whole ring around the country. And we broke down.
In every single city.
In every single city, every single state. We broke down. I can't remember even the last count how many places we broke down. So just lots of challenges. None of us were particularly good at diesel mechanics. We've all gotten much better. But you introduce some challenges when you start using vegetable oil. But the bus really was an amazing way to bring people together. For instance, in Berkeley, right outside of Oakland, one of the urban farmers, a famous urban farmer, Novella Carpenter, who's famous for growing livestock in her backyard, just so turns out that her boyfriend is a veggie diesel mechanic who rides a bicycle around and is literally like a roving diesel mechanic on a bicycle. So we break down in Berkeley. We know Novella. We call her. She's like, oh, my boyfriend can come over there and help you.
A veggie diesel mechanic who rides a bicycle in Berkeley?
In Berkeley.
No.
No. I know it sounds astronomical, but it's exactly what you find in Berkeley.
Tell us about your experience in urban farming at the Jones Valley Farm and how you sort of looked out on a macro basis to see it as a movement. Tell us about your experience coming up there.
Yeah, I mean, really, that was the intention of starting a farm in Birmingham, was that I wanted to instigate a movement. I saw that there was a lot of pieces in place to help a local food, sustainable food movement in Birmingham. None of that was really coalesced. There was some interest. There was some excitement. There were chefs, for instance, that were demanding locally grown products. There were consumers demanding the locally grown products. There was lots of vacant land. There was, you know, just basically a pretty favorable landscape, but the pieces hadn't been put together. So I moved back to Birmingham, where I grew up, and started working, got access to some land, and then most importantly, were able to pull people together, passionate people, just came out of the woodwork. I mean, every single day we were out farming, new groups of people showed up, new individuals showed up, and, you know, sort of desperate to have something to plug into and to engage in. And that's really where I think the power of urban agriculture comes in, is that it creates a way for passionate people to find something to plug into and to create a common experience. So you don't feel like that you're isolated in your vision, that your food system should be different. And really, I mean, in Birmingham, there wasn't that. There was just no place for people to plug in. This tiny little piece of property that we converted, quarter acre farm into a production space, was really a gathering place. And that's really the power of it. It was a community gathering place. And so that one thing led to another. And 10 years later, we had 28 acres in production and you know, thousands of people participating in our events. We had created that tidal wave of interest. And then the most important part was instigating other projects around the city. So community gardens, school gardens, other for-profit production urban farms starting up, you know, food banks interested all of a sudden in actually using fresh local produce instead of just the canned processed stuff to address food security. So really, you know, creating that place for people to plug in, and then that movement sort of becomes a power unto itself.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR. Streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Edwin Marty, one of the authors of Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. It's a photo essay and narrative book about 12 different cities that he and a partner traveled to, exploring the evolution of urban farming as it is now. Kansas City, what are your experiences with urban farming here in the metro, and what do you think about the long-term viability of urban farming? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also contact us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Give us a shout on your urban farming experiences and your thoughts on whether there's long-term viability for urban farming. Now, you travel to 12 cities, Edwin. Out of the 12 cities that you traveled to, which city stood out to you as sort of early beacons of urban farm movement?
Yeah, I mean, not to just speak to my local audience, but Kansas City certainly has one of the more progressive, impressive organizations in the country. I mean, Cultivate Kansas City really is, without a doubt, one of the examples that I point to consistently as having some of the better leadership. I mean, I think Catherine and some of the other folks that are involved in Cultivate Kansas City have really been on the front edge of thinking about the model and thinking about how can you structure urban agriculture to be successful. I mean, the project that they've developed at Juniper Gardens to basically provide a training model and actually space for new immigrants to the United States to learn about urban agriculture, to have a market to sell products, and then a logical progression for them to move into the for-profit realm is so critical. And I mean, it's like nothing else being done around the country in terms of thinking about how to integrate urban agriculture into the real economy. And, you know, there's lots of projects from one side of the country to another, most of them nonprofits, most of them not really interested or concerned about how does it work in the real economy. And what's happening here in Kansas City is that the model is being developed right now.
Juniper Gardens did appear in your book, so you were being set up for that question.
It's true.
What did you find to be unique about Juniper Gardens other than the refugee program and other than its proximity to the city? There's a beautiful picture in the book of the farmland with the skyline in the backdrop. It's just east of the city proper. What stood out?
I think the intentional vision for what's going to happen in 3 to 5 years, and that's what I don't see happening in other places around the country, is really thinking about where are these people that are working with us going to be, and how can we create an environment that's going to be conducive for their success as urban farmers. And one of the analogies that I make a lot of times is that the food system is a train, and that train is moving down some tracks, and things like the Farm Bill are the things that put those tracks in place. You know, what Nixon did back in the 60s in terms of the development of a get big or get out policy laid down the tracks that are creating our food system as we speak. To change the direction of that train, to make it more a locally focused, sustainably focused food system, the tracks need to be changed years ahead of time. They need to be changed miles ahead so that when the train is approaching that point, it's going to move in a different direction.
Staying with that metaphor for a little bit, do you see the current large monocrop manufacturing ethos of agribusiness, do you see that leading to the food system derailing?
Oh, I mean, unquestionably. I think that when you look at the confluence of a couple of things, fuel, it's a limited resource. While the fuel prices are going down a little bit right now, there is, I don't think anybody on earth that's going to argue that in certain amount of time, fuel prices are going to skyrocket, which completely derails the entire paradigm that our food system is currently based on. But secondly, water is just as important and just as critical of a resource. I was just reading a great article in Harper's Magazine about the real challenge that the Midwest and the Great Plains is going to experience in maybe even a short 5 to 10 year time frame. The water that's available currently for large-scale irrigation of grain crops is disappearing very, very quickly. And that's going to change the entire structure of the way our food system works. So what's the option? And what are the viable other models? And what's happening here in Kansas City is the creation of an alternative system that's potentially, you know, scalable. I mean, we could have thousands and thousands and thousands of these small urban farms producing huge quantities of food and literally feeding the entire city.
Speaking of the entire city, you spoke last night at the Kansas City Public Library. What were some of the key points that came up or the key questions that folks posed to you here in Kansas City?
I think one of the really great questions for all of us in America is we've you know, either intentionally or unintentionally been involved in the suburbanization of our country. And most kids these days are growing up in suburban areas. You know, the vast majority of our energies from a development point of view are going into the development of suburban communities. Are those communities sustainable in any way? And how does a food system integrate into a suburban culture? You know, what's going to happen when the price of fuel hits $5 a gallon? How are those suburban communities going to function? And one of the real problems, I think, in America is crumbling infrastructure for suburban communities. It takes so much money to support a suburban community. And if the tax base disappears, that's going to fall apart. I mean, I think Detroit is a really good litmus test for what happens when you have highly non-concentrated housing and try to have a small tax base support that infrastructure. It doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work. And yet every city in America has got that same system. You know, how is that going to work? And then what's going to happen in terms of food security when people live in these suburban communities that don't have access to their own transportation? They're not going to have access to food. We're going to have basically an epidemic of food insecurity in suburban communities.
So the suburban model, the Levitt towns and the outlying areas, these sort of Pleasantvilles, and that's unsustainable as well.
I'm completely and utterly unsustainable. I mean, we think that we have problems right now with food insecurity in urban settings, and there's a lot of energy being put into, you know, making sure that urban centers are food secure through farmers markets and through farm stands and through getting vegetables into corner stores and through getting grocery stores back into urban areas. And these are great, important missions and I think very viable projects, but they're very doable, frankly, compared to looking at how do you do the same thing in a suburban community that has so little density and such a huge need for infrastructure. It's simply not going to be a model that's going to work. And I frankly don't really know what we're going to do about it.
And one of the ironic things is that a lot of suburban land is gleaned from old farmland.
The best farmland in America currently. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's still to this day, the rate of paving of just incredibly fertile farmland simultaneously, you know, the infrastructure is disappearing. It's the most asinine model that you could possibly imagine.
Initially, a lot of urban farms are servicing food banks, for instance, gleaning crops for shelters. How much of those instances did you see on your tour, and what are some examples?
There's some unbelievable models out there. I mean, again, food insecurity is a significant challenge in every single city, and it's unfortunately still a very hidden part of modern America, that this idea that we have people that simply don't have enough food or not the right kind of food, it's pervasive. Every city I've been to, everywhere in the country, that's the same story. And urban agriculture does a great job of A, creating capacity for communities to feed themselves, and then B, making the food system more efficient. You know, we basically throw away about 50% of all our food. Every pound of food that's produced, about a half a pound of that's thrown away. So an urban farm and food system movements can push us to be more efficient. I think it's critically important.
We got Clay in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to Central Standard, Clay.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a great program. And I specifically, I do some volunteer work with local organization, Society of St. Andrews, and what they do is do gleaning work. They go out and harvest vegetables and fruits from local urban, not only urban, but a lot of rural farmers who are raising the vegetables, and then any leftover produce they give away. The problem is, and then that produce then is picked up, is gleaned, harvested, and then taken to local food pantries here in the city for people in our food deserts here in the city that are, as you've already spoken to the issue, that it's a big, big need. But one common thread that you were speaking to earlier that I see here in the city, a large need, is the problem of getting volunteers, getting the produce harvested out in urban and rural farms. Some of these farms are actually, could be acre or acres located within the city limits. And it is a big problem. Just one quick thing. I got an urgent message today from Society of St. Andrews that they have 4,800 pounds of zucchini and cucumbers to be picked up in Trenton, Missouri. And if it's not picked up today and distributed to food banks or food pantries, it'll be ruined. And they've been trying desperately to find somebody to pick it up, and unsuccessful. This isn't the only time this has happened. We get urgent messages frequently about assistance, asking for assistance in harvesting and transporting the vegetables back here to the urban area, to the food banks.
Thank you, Clay, for contributing to the conversation there. The challenge of transporting these crops, whether they be gleaned or whether they be fresh, to be distributed in the urban area.
It's a wonderful point. Society of St. Andrews does such a good job nationally. In every city that I know, they're somewhere embedded in the community, working and making the food system, frankly, more efficient and making it more just and addressing so many of the critical issues. I mean, the challenge, as the caller noted, was transportation. I mean, the whole idea of urban agriculture is remove the transportation quandary. When you produce food in proximity to where people live, you don't have to transport the food. I mean, you create a completely different ball game. You're completely removed from the price of fuel. You're completely removed from the need for infrastructure. I mean, it's a really important part. So hopefully, as more urban farms develop in every city, we'll see food insecurity disappearing as people simply are in direct proximity to their food production.
Andy in Blue Springs, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I'm just amazed at your contention about the fuel. The whole reason you go to larger farms is you produce more crops with less fuel. Transportation for crops is not the big part of the fuel cost. It's the production. The idea that you can make enough urban farms, enough crop from an urban farm to feed a urban area of millions of people, I just find that amazingly naive.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. And certainly, you know, not only the production, the fuel costs for tractors, but the petroleum used in synthetic fertilizers and all the different products. I mean, it's definitely we live in a very petroleum intensive food system. And there's absolutely no question. I mean, I appreciate your point. I guess all I can say is I'll bring up the example again. I mean, Havana, Cuba produces a lot of its own food. I mean, there is a living, breathing example that we could both go to tomorrow and see an example of. It may not be replicatable on every level, but I have absolutely no doubt that, for one, urban agriculture is incredibly effective at producing huge quantities of food on very small pieces of land. And I think that's one of the fallacies that I come across over and over again, is this idea that you have to have millions of acres to feed a community. And that's just not true. I mean, there are examples throughout time of very small scale production replicated extensively to produce huge quantities of food. So, I mean, I think, you know, in America, we have bought this idea that we have to have entire states, you know, with gigantic tractors to produce huge quantities of food. And while, yes, that's true, I mean, there's another example. I mean, there's other ways to do it. Large quantities of food can be produced on small quantities of land using intensive methods. And then, as I touched on earlier, the efficiency of our food system is the real culprit, that if we were more efficient about how we used our food, I mean, the previous caller just said that, you know, 5,000 pounds of squash are about to be thrown away. I mean, how can we create a better system where we don't have to overproduce constantly, which isn't good for anybody? Instead, if we can have a more efficient system producing less, but being better about getting those products directly to the markets.
So his assertion that the urban farm movement is sort of naive at its roots is erroneous to you.
I mean, I think that it is important to recognize there has to be a continuum of production scales. There has to be large-scale production for certain parts of the food system. There has to be medium-scale production. But what I think the modern American has completely forgotten is that the small-scale producer is incredibly important and can be incredibly efficient. It's not, I mean, you know, grain production on small scales in urban settings doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. But that continuum that provides large, medium, and small scale, with urban agriculture being an important part, not the only part, but an important part of that production system, creates a better, stronger, more resilient, frankly, safer system.
David in KCK, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks, Javelani. Great show. Great particular article this time. I want to back up the author a little bit about fuel costs. It's not just fuel and transportation costs that are going to be the main issue. All those fossil energy supplies are going to go through the roof at the same time. And what you're going to have is a lack of the pesticides and fertilizers and other inputs that our industrial agriculture is based on today. The small-scale farms, the small ones like the ones that cultivate KC, the new roots for refugees, the bad seed, herbivore farms, and so on, are doing things without those inputs and making more money per acre than any conventional farmer could ever dream of. These are the things we need to post up and tell people about. And just want to thank you for doing what you do.
Dave, you're from KC Food Circle.
That's right.
Correct? Tell us a little bit about that group.
Well, we're a nonprofit. We're kind of a spinoff project from the Heart of America Action Linkage. It's a 501c3 that came out of the Kansas City Greens. And we've been doing this for about 20 years, putting local eaters together with local organic and local free-range growers for about 20 years. We started off with four or five farmers in our directory, and now we're up to close to 80. And we work closely with organizations like Cultivate KC and sometimes Society of St. Andrews, but we're mainly out there trying to make sure people know where to find the food they want and help them get and put a face on the food.
Thank you, Dave, for calling. Talk about the input costs that industrial farms currently incur.
Well, I mean, one thing, just, and thank you for the caller, but I do want to touch on one really interesting point for me, that we use this term conventional farming. And as an anthropologist, I'm obsessed with language and sort of how we define the issues. So conventional agriculture is basically what we all think of as normal agriculture, large-scale rural agriculture using synthetic fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides. My contention with that point is, what's conventional about that, and when did it become conventional? So 75, 80 years ago, before we had these synthetic products that are produced in a lab, conventional agriculture was what we now call organic farming, which is now called non-traditional farming. So we have this very strange language issue, and frankly, I think it's important for us all to recognize that what we call conventional and traditional rural agriculture is, an absolutely new invention. And it's frankly, I think, still in the trial phase of, do synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides really work in the long term? We don't know that. But organic farming is something that we've been doing for 12, 15,000 years. I mean, 99% of all the humans on Earth ate organic food exclusively. And yet, just in the last 80 years, we've seen a radical transformation of our entire food system. I'll stop mentioning Havana, Cuba after this, but what happened in Cuba when the Soviets pulled out, they no longer had access to petroleum, which meant they couldn't run their tractors. But much more importantly, as the caller touched on, they didn't have the capacity to produce those synthetic petroleum-based fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. So they had to create an entire industry out of things that were locally available. And frankly, from what I can tell, they did a heck of a good job creating a locally grown industry, not just food, but an entire industry. So really good examples, and I think we have great templates to move forward.
Our guest is Edwin Marty, one of the authors of Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we continue to cultivate the conversation on urban farming with tips on everything from growing to government programs and community involvement, plus the challenges urban farmers still face. Kansas City, what are your experiences with urban farming here in the metro, and what do you think about its long-term viability? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. In our busy modern world, we take many things for granted. For instance, the bizarre idea that meat comes in a little yellow tray and it's cold and it's wrapped in a little plastic wrap, or that vegetables just show up under a light at the supermarket. To many, the urban farming movement is the missing link in understanding the origins of what's on our plate at present and what will be in the future of food in general. We now continue our discussion on urban farm and the urban farm movement with Edwin Marty, one of the authors of Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. Meanwhile, Kansas City, what are your experiences with urban farming here in the metro, and what do you think about the long-term viability of urban farming? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Speaking of which, John writes, my son is running an urban farm project for the Gillis School on Warnell. My question is about the distribution system for urban farm produce. I'm worried about actually too many farmers markets being created, which means it's hard to sell enough to make money at these small locations. Is too much small farmers markets competition sustainable? How do we reduce that waste?
Yeah, I mean,
interesting
great
question.
Yeah, great question. And in fact, we are seeing throughout the cities that I visited the exact opposite problem, that farmers markets are exploding still, even though the movement is fairly mature. There's still new farmers markets popping up every single day in cities across America. The problem is lack of producers. I very, very rarely hear farmers lamenting that there's too much competition. It does occasionally happen, but still the prevailing issue in farmers markets from New York City to Los Angeles to New Orleans to Seattle is, as new farmers markets come online and as new communities want those markets, there's just not enough producers. So I think it's great for the urban agriculture movement to recognize that what we need to be doing is training new farmers and making sure that they're well-trained, supported, and have access to the resources that are going to make them successful and at the right scale.
Rudolph in Kansas City, Missouri, wrote in with a question as well. With all the savings that are involved in urban agriculture, why is produce from organic urban agriculture still more expensive per unit than produce from organic rural farms?
And the price of food discussion is a very big, complicated beast. Let's put it that way. Why does food cost what it does? So there's a whole spectrum of different things, from USDA subsidization of certain aspects of the food system to marketing prioritizations for gigantic corporations. I wish that it was as simple as saying that the farmer, you know, recognizes how much it costs to produce a product and then turns around and sells that product to you. But nothing could be further from the truth. What most urban farmers do, from my research, is they go to the Whole Foods and they see what Whole Foods is charging for a product. They turn around and they try to get that same price. So like every single market, you know, you're trying to set your price so that you can sell everything that you produce, and not have to take anything home while being able to cover as much of your cost of production as possible. So organic farming is more expensive because it's more labor intensive. I mean, that's the issue. And then, you know, while you're not having to pay transportation costs, often the other costs that go along with urban farming are more expensive. Land costs, labor costs, frankly, a lot more expensive, paying somebody that lives in a city versus paying somebody that lives in a rural community. So lots of extra costs go into urban farming.
Andrew, one of our listeners, is interested in learning more about the Havana, Cuba example. Havana can produce 12 months a year, presumably. Kansas City and Kansas and Missouri, this area cannot.
Oh, but that's it what can. That's I think, what he's yeah, I mean, there, absolutely, there's no doubt that in a place like Havana, you know, you walk outside and you get hit by an avocado and, you know, and life is good. There are great examples of cities in very northern climates using crop protection systems to produce food year-round using energy unintensive systems. Growing Power is the name of an organization in Milwaukee, a fairly famous, well-established urban farm that is based on greenhouse production in an urban area, basically building greenhouses on vacant properties all over Milwaukee, producing huge quantities of food using aquaculture, integrating fish production into greenhouse production, using gigantic quantities of compost, getting compost turned over from grocery stores that have produced huge quantities at a low cost, and using that to increase their production capacities in greenhouses. So it can be done, but it does require training. And one of the things I think a critical component for the future of urban agriculture is research. Land grant institutes using urban agriculture as a tool to increase potential production. We need to have more research. We need to have more people out there looking at what are the opportunities to increase the efficiency of urban farming and how to extend those seasons.
Land-grant universities have traditionally had cooperative extensions to provide resources to rural agriculture and people in rural agribusiness. You now see that changing to evolve into the urban farming space.
Absolutely. And, you know, County Extension, to give them credit, have always had urban specialists. But those urban specialists have been about how do you get your turf to grow and how do you get your ornamentals to grow. And that's been great. But I think there is a radical mission change that needs to happen, that recognizing for urban farmers to be successful and to scale up to a level where they can literally start feeding a substantial portion of the community, research has to be there. Again, the last time I'll say it, in Havana, what happened was the institutions, you know, changed their focus radically from researching export-oriented crops like tobacco and sugarcane to creating solutions for urban and organic farming. If the same thing happened, you know, if you look at how much money traditional croppage systems in America get from land grants in terms of research, it's in the billions of dollars. If those same kind of percentages were reoriented, refocused on urban production, we could see incredible changes in the technology that was available.
Tom in Kansas City, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, I just wanted to make two things, comments. One about composting with worms, and then also about growing fruit and nut trees in an urban setting. Number one, I compost with worms, and it is amazing the appetite worms have for eating everything that is waste from your kitchen, from coffee grinds to eggshells to everything that you trim up to make a salad. They eat it, they compost it out, and it's amazing when you use that as a fertilizer how your plants absolutely just pop outside. And the other thing is using fruit trees and nut trees in an urban setting. There's a company called Stark Brothers on the other side of the state that's been around for 200 years, and you can get all different sizes of trees, from semi-dwarf to dwarf to standard. They have varieties that have very low usage of either pesticides or fungicides, you can get pears and plums and peaches and apples and every kind of nut underneath the sun. And, it, you know, plant it, you go outside and you pick it, and it's, you know where it's coming from, and there's no transportation cost for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years of production.
Thank you, Tom, for those suggestions and for contributing to the conversation on urban farming. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Edwin Marty, one of the authors of Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival. He spoke last night at the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch. Kansas City, what are your experience with urban farming here in the metro, and what do you think about its long-term viability? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Edwin, your book challenges the perception of urban farmers as new farmer stereotypes, the upper middle class, 20-something white people. Tell us about the other examples you came across and how this can be a movement that stretches across racial and socioeconomic backgrounds.
And it really was the most exciting part of the whole experience for me, driving around the country and just getting to meet just such a wild diversity of folks all engaged in urban agriculture. And really, undoubtedly, the most engaging group that we spent time with was the Vietnamese immigrant group in New Orleans. I mean, this community that literally brought their agricultural tradition from Vietnam to New Orleans and just set up shop basically on the riverbanks of New Orleans and started farming in the exact same kind of traditional methods that they had used in Vietnam, and were able to produce basically all of the food that this Vietnamese community consumed was produced on the riverbanks inside their own community. I mean, just an amazing example of appropriate technology, sustainable food production, creating a local food system. And again, the neat thing about the Vietnamese community was only elders were participating in the agricultural system. Young people, maybe kids, were helping their grandparents, but the adults were actually not participating at all. And it's a very common, apparently, tradition in Vietnam that, you know, adults are out doing their day job, working, running businesses. When you retire or when you're too old to participate in the family business, you go back into growing food. And it's a generational change. And it's not just that right now it's only old Vietnamese immigrants farming. It changes each cycle. It goes on and on and on. So it's a very sustainable way to look at a community producing its own food. And just again, it's not just an age issue. It's not just a racial issue or an economic issue. I mean, this is across the board. People throughout the country growing their own food and just doing a wonderful job.
How do you make urban areas farmable again? Or farmable in the first place? What's involved in that process?
Yeah, I mean, one of the real issues that we came across over and over again is that obviously industry is usually an integral part of the development of an urban area. In Birmingham, where I lived, was the steel capital of the country for years. Unfortunately, industry often contaminates properties and at the very least leaves behind things like concrete and those things that are often very difficult to integrate into a farming system. So getting soil tested, and just please, if you hear anything today, take this away, that soil testing is a absolutely critical part of any urban agriculture project. Before doing anything, soil should be tested, sent off to labs. Most land-grant institutes can do basic soil testing for things like lead and arsenic. I would never grow food on a piece of urban property that had not been tested for heavy metals first. I think it's absolutely critical. So once the testing's done, more often than not, you'll find out that you're fine. And then adding that compost, getting that soil fertility up. Maybe to address two of the previous callers, earthworms, an amazing way to increase soil fertility over a very short period of time. To create an efficient, highly productive urban farm that is capable of feeding huge numbers of people, earthworms and their poop is the answer, undoubtedly so.
There's also a how-to component in your book for people interested in urban farming. And one striking tip was advocating for change in your city's zoning codes. Tell us about that, the planning and zoning component to fostering urban farm growth.
More often than not, it's actually illegal to be an urban farmer. And that's one of the things I joked about all the time in Birmingham, that we had this 3.5-acre farm right in the middle of the city, and it was illegal. Fortunately, the city ignored us completely, and so we were able to get away with it. But it's very rare that you are legally allowed to sell the products that you produce on your urban farm from the farm. And so there's been a wave of interest around the country in looking at the zoning codes for cities and how they integrate and support urban agriculture. Cleveland, one of the real leading cities in terms of developing new, exciting, supportive urban agriculture zoning. So they have basically created an urban agriculture zoning code so that you can change your zoning code to urban agriculture, which means that you can produce larger you can house larger numbers of animals, livestock on your property and sell from your property. But they've also created an incentivization program where if you apply to the city to become an urban farmer, you can get city-owned land leased for free. So basically the city vets your application. If they think you're legitimate, you get a city-owned piece of property to start your urban farm project.
So once you've gotten your piece of land and once you've settled a planning and zoning snafu, if you will, you say the main obstacle facing urban farmers is also land that can be expensive in urban areas if you don't get those land grants. How do you see this challenge being addressed in the cities you visited, and how can it be addressed going forward?
Yeah, the cost of urban land is a challenging one. You look at places like New York City, just property values that are astronomical. You cannot conceive of the value of those pieces of property. But, the answer there, going up. I mean, looking on top of the roofs, and one of the examples we have in the book is
Miss Novak.
Exactly. Just amazing farmer in Brooklyn, Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, growing beautiful food, chickens on top of the roof in Brooklyn. The food that's produced is sold within a couple blocks of the farm. I mean, you think about that in terms of localizing your food system. A couple of blocks from the farm, everything is sold. That, for me, is the ultimate local food system. But that's one way to deal with the challenges. You know, it's in a place like New York where there's just not land, but you do have all these warehouses that are actually appropriate for potentially growing food on the roof.
How do you grow food on a roof?
Yeah, and
talk about that process.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing that's being explored in a lot of different ways. So the first and foremost issue is, does the roof have capacity to hold weight? Not every roof is going to be like that, but a lot of older buildings, a lot of older warehouses are built with heavy concrete that have the capacity to have a lot of weight put on them. The Eagle Street Rooftop Farm was a perfect situation because the warehouse that was built was actually intended to be a much taller building. So the first, say, five floors were built expecting to have another 20 floors put on them. They didn't. So you have an incredibly strong infrastructure. So they were able to put a lot of heavy soil up onto the roof and then start farming literally just on top of that roof line. The really cool thing is it's great for stormwater management issues. Most cities have real problems when you have big rainfalls. A lot of that water hits impermeable surfaces and moves straight down into the stormwater drains, which takes all the pollutants into the creeks, which really heavily impacts your environment. One thing that a lot of cities are looking at is a taxation system for warehouse and building owners. For every amount of water that falls off of your building untreated, you get taxed. So one way to mediate that would be to have a rooftop farm on top of your roof so that the amount of untreated water pouring off your building is reduced radically. Your taxation rate goes down radically. So you basically are incentivizing an entire urban farm rooftop movement through a taxation code.
As an ethnobiologist, you examine the sort of anthropological evolution and movement of cultures and their relationship to a given ecosystem. And you mentioned water being one of the concerns of the future. Elaborate on that again regarding water cost and water runoff and water management, freshwater management in the future.
Yeah, there is absolutely nobody, I think, that's looked at this issue and not agreed that in the next 50 years, water will be the limiting natural resource for humans' existence on Earth. We are going to have water wars that are, I think, unprecedented and I think to some degree unavoidable. The way that our food system has evolved in the last 75 years has assumed that we have access to an unlimited supply of fresh water. And that, unfortunately, is just simply not true. There are documented cases throughout the history of human civilization where when you use your natural resources unsustainably, there's a consequence. And unfortunately, I think we're setting ourselves up to be dependent on a food system that is absolutely, utterly, completely unsustainable in terms of our water usage. Water, the aquifers in the Midwest are drying up as we speak, fairly documented cases of that. How are we going to produce the same kind of foods that we've produced without those kind of water access issues? again, efficiency of our production system, growing smaller, more efficient, more effective mechanisms. Going back to our previous caller, dependence on perennial crops that don't use the amount of volume of water that annual crops use is incredibly important. There's some great research being done right now on looking at how to create perennial wheat crops so that we don't have to have annual production of an annual tilling of soil that's incredibly water depletive. But in an urban setting, if you set up raised beds properly, they can be unbelievably efficient, and you can actually recycle the vast majority of the water that you use on an urban farm. So I think just the research has to be done right now. I mean, I think there is an incredible need to prioritize those research needs to make efficient, somewhat self-contained urban agriculture systems.
You have a phrase that you use in your book and that you're wearing on the face of your T-shirt right now. Eat your view. Eat your view. What does eat your view mean? Explain what that means for our
community. Yeah, it's a great phrase that comes out of Sweden, and I won't try to translate it for our Swedish-speaking audience. The general idea is you vote every time you buy something. So when you go to the store and you buy some food, you're voting. You are a very active participant in the construction of your food system by voting for a food product. When you buy something, you vote for more of that product, the way that it was produced, the way it was packaged, the way it was sold to you, every aspect of how that product got to your got into your hands, you're voting for more of it. So whatever you're voting for more of eventually is going to surround you. If you vote by going to the farmer's market and buying locally produced organic products from a local urban farm, you're voting for more of those urban farms using sustainable techniques and being good stewards of the land. Conversely, when you go to a store and buy the absolute easiest, most convenient, cheapest product, you're voting for more of that kind of product. So if you want to be surrounded by more beautiful urban farms that are being good stewards of your earth, support those farms, and eventually you'll be surrounded by them. So eat your view. You're voting when you eat, and eventually whatever you vote for, you're going to be surrounded by, and you'll see every day.
Our guest is Edwin Marty, one of the authors of Breaking Through Concrete, Building an Urban Farm Revival, says eat your view. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Tune in tomorrow as we chat with airplane pilot Jamal Larkins and talk about his crusade to get young people interested in careers in transportation. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with author Jeff Broadwater and a chat about his book on President James Madison. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.